This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. We are going to start today with a new book from photographer Wayne Goodmanson. It's called A Song for Leave. Wayne, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So it's named after your daughter, Leave.
Correct.
But also the word leave in Icelandic translates to life.
Correct.
So talk about the double meaning of this title, A Song for Leave, A Song for Life.
Well, I will. I read a book by Bruce Chatwin called Song Lines. And in that book, he traces the custom of the Aboriginal people who are nomadic and wandering around. And this is pre-written language. And to keep track of their travels, they would make a song. And the songs had to do with the landscape, of course, because they're recording their travels. So it's kind of an audio map, if you will, from this mountain to that river across this desert and so forth. But folded into that sort of factual map was things that happened to them, a birth, a death, a broken leg, hunger, whatever. So it's kind of a sense of place. Because it's about these people and their relationship to the land. Mm-hmm. And then the part that really struck me, the real poignant issue in there, was that they felt if the song wasn't sung, the land would die.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely wonderful because it means that it's then incumbent upon them to sing their song.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep alive their memories, their time on the planet, their sense of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And so early on, maybe when I was 6 years old, I would visit my grandparents' home in Mountain, North Dakota, and we would go up there. And a six-year-old is kind of this androgynous creature. I could be in the camp with the women at the farm or with the men. And,
mm-hmm.
And anyway, so I gravitated towards the male side. And after talking about the weather and new cars or farm machinery, they would start to recite the poetry of a man named Cowan Julius, who was known as Cowan, which is K-N in Icelandic. And so as a six-year-old, I thought, well, this is kind of interesting that these grown men would – take joy in reciting poetry about this guy. And they would say it in Icelandic first, and then many of the poems were translated to those of us who didn't know Icelandic. Hmm. And but they took just such great joy. And I remember thinking, you know, it'd be okay to be a man, you know, to recite no poetry, recite it, enjoy it. And so I became fascinated with this guy. And there was also he was an itinerant worker, as many people were, and he published his first book of poetry in 1920 in Icelandic in Winnipeg. That was an Icelandic stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, there's a line, Winnipeg, Gimli, Mountain,
yeah,
right?
And Minnesota, where Bill Holm is from, is
okay.
Another of those strongholds. And since 1920, he has never been out of print in the Icelandic language. So I was always fascinated with this guy. Who was he? What's the story about this guy who affected the community in that way? And I was telling Dennis Hamilton, a good friend of mine, who you know of, and
Doug's brother, if I'm not mistaken.
Doug's brother,
okay.
Exactly. And he saw, you got to call Bill Holm, who's a known poet and a character in many ways. And so I called up Bill and I said, my name's Wayne Goodmanson and I'm doing this project, kind of backed into it. And I said, it involves this guy named Cowan Julius. And Bill says, another expletive, Icelander. And then Bill launches into a poem in Icelandic by Cowan about the time Cowan visited Minnesota. And because Minnesota was dry then, he couldn't get a drink. And so he called the people from Minnesota ugly people. And so it's like, you know, when you fish and you catch a big one. So
yeah.
The project on. So Bill and I were going to do this project on Cowan Julius.
Mm.
And so we did a lot of talking to old people and people my dad knew and my grandparents knew, et cetera, et cetera, and started to put together a picture of who Cowan was. And then we realized, because it's going to be my photography paired with Bill's translations of Cowan's poetry and some insights into who he was as a man. Mm-hmm. And at the core of this was how one culture revered him, i.e. the Icelanders, and kids grew up memorizing his poetry, not just with this group of men in Mountain but across the country, and how another community tolerated him because, as one woman said, he was something of a scallywag. So that was kind of – that was it. And so that's what in 1993 got me to Iceland. And so I found out where Cowan was from and made those photographs of the place. And whenever I travel, I'm always reading the books of the writers from there and the history of the place. And I came across a genealogical line of mine that went back to a man named Grímur Kamban, who was the first settler of the Faroe Islands in 1825.
And this goes back 20-plus generations.
Yeah, 29.
29, okay.
And so I said, well, I wonder where my people came from. So I set out to photograph as many ancestral landscapes as I could.
Hmm.
And so what the book is about, or the form that's worth noting, because it's not traditional chronology of these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of vignettes, and it's my photograph of this place paired with a diary-esque kind of entry. It talks about the wind, the weather, whatever,
mm-hmm.
how I found the place. And then the center part is kind of my sense of that place and maybe the person who lived there or the people that lived there. And what about the emigration experience? Mm-hmm. And what about – what was their life like and so forth? And so this thing is more – this book is more of my reaction to these places than it is some kind of spelling out my genealogy.
Mm. It starts with a poem about a funeral. And we've already established that leave translates to life, a song for life, a song for your daughter, and it starts with a funeral. What has just acknowledging that death is absolutely going to happen, how does that change how you approach living?
Well, very directly. I mean, it is carpe diem. I mean, you seize the day and get what you can and find meaning for who you are as a person and what makes you tick. And so I think it's looking back on how these people went about their business, who mm-hmm. they were as seen through those landscapes. And I wanted to pass that on to my daughter. So I finished this thing probably 16, 17 years ago and put it away. I gave it to Leave. She was on an exchange program in France, and she was a junior in high school, and I gave it to her. And then that was it. And then she had, you know, the next generation appeared. So a little guy named Emil Goodmanson showed up, followed by Colette Goodmanson. So I dusted it off, not wanting to kind of add more chapters to this, but you know, the urge to kind of share something, you know, kind of remind her that it's her song now. So anyway, so yes, and then in cleaning it up a bit because there were some rough edges and some things didn't make sense, I showed it to a friend who runs the NDSU Press, Suzanne Kelly, and she said, well, maybe we should publish this. And then Tom Tamaro, an old friend, offered some good advice in addition to a blurb, and I rewrote the epigraphs for the six chapters to bring in more of the writings of, well, Cowan Julius, for instance, or Haldur Laxness, the one Nobel Prize winner from Iceland, and Norse mythology, of course. And that's it. And so I was able to give a copy of this to Leave and two books that maybe in 30, 40, 50 years, Emil and Colette might find interesting. Not now.
We're visiting with photographer and writer Wayne Goodmanson. His latest book is called A Song for Leave. And Wayne, you talked about being able to trace your ancestors back 29 generations. And I noticed in the book that they are primarily living, you mentioned the Faroe Islands, and then one little corner of Iceland for 20-some generations. They're there in that one spot. And I want to compare that with your immediate family right now. You grew up in the Fargo-Moorhead area. Your wife is from England. Your daughter lives in France. And so just within this generational shift, you are representing three different countries across two different continents. And compare that with this lineage that goes back to one place.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a good point. It's a very good question. But I think of Grimur Kamban, who was the first – well – the Irish monks were there before, but they didn't have too many kids to stay on.
Yeah, and monks aren't known for that.
No, not their long suit. But he picked up his last name, which is a Celtic name, probably because of his time on the Isle of Man. So there's a mixed marriage, if you will, there. And he goes to the Faroe Islands, and his son and grandson were some of the first people to discover Iceland. So already that movement, you know, from – well, it probably originally came from southwest Norway. So
okay.
From Norway to the Faroe Islands,
okay.
To the Isle of Man,
mm-hmm.
Back to the Faroe Islands, then to the northeast corner of Iceland for about 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And then
do you think we can develop that same sense of place even now when it's so easy to just jet off to somewhere else?
I think so. I mean, a sense of place exists because you invest something in it. You have some perception. You know, you have some – and it might just be fleeting, but, you know, a moment, a rich moment lived makes a place. So, I mean, the world's just spinning faster. And so we're probably a product of that because you know, I was in the Navy on Guam, of all places, and traveled a bit there and did my student teaching in Copenhagen, met Jane there. We were married in England. We were on our way to Mexico. We stopped in Moorhead to teach. I taught a class at MSUM. Went to the Creative Arts Studio, back to MSUM. So kind of always on the move. And then leave goes to French camp and then studies in France. And majored in international relations. And so when she went to their second time during college, that she should have an international relationship shouldn't it come as a surprise. And she's not coming back to South Moorhead as far as I can tell.
Yeah, my daughter moved to Brazil and then I knew, okay, she's not coming back to Moorhead. I'm interested in a turn of phrase that you used, I think, in your very first answer, and it shows up in the book a couple of times. You say that you make a photograph or you make a picture. Other people would say that they take a photo or take a picture. What's the distinction between making a photo and taking a photo?
Well, it's a huge difference. You know, to take a photograph, you are literally taking something. But to make a photograph has to be a greater investment, perceptive investment. And as you know, I taught photography and
– to me, in fact.
Yeah, to you, in fact, and you survived. So it has to do with what that moment that you press the shutter button. I mean, if you compare painting to photography, in painting you make a mark, you step back, you look at it. You can go up, you can add something to that, you can erase it, you can paint over it, you can go. So, but photographs are born whole, and it's what you bring to that moment when you press the shutter button that makes it a photograph. And so it's that investment. It has to do with place so much too. I mean, you're investing in that place. So done well, it becomes a without getting too carried away, becomes a heightened experience.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, I ended up taking a lot of photographs and I ended up making a few.
It's no easy feat to do this work in the winter in places like Iceland. There are a couple of good anecdotes in the story about times where you could almost not even get a shot off. And sometimes it was Iceland, sometimes it was a blizzard outside of Mountain, North Dakota. So just these moments of you're out there, you have every intention of making this photo, and then the weather says, well, hey, I'm the one in charge. But you still have to be present in this moment while sort of making sure that you survive the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's serious stuff. As people who live where we live, blizzards are not to be trifled with. But the conditions are always changing. I always thought that if I shoot with a large format, that's a tripod and a 4x5 view camera where you
– Yeah, your equipment's large.
It's large and cumbersome. But still, I always thought, well, this will be easy. You put it on a tripod and you just sort of wait till the right moment appears. But it's just so ephemeral. It changes so quickly.
Mm.
So you have to be sort of hyper-tuned to what's in front of you. And I think that's where sort of the adrenaline gets going.
Mm.
And you see that moment. And sometimes they get away very quickly and you miss them. And so you just have to kind of be on your game. And you try to be non-literal and have a visceral response. So maybe something of that place, you know, evokes something. And then you got it.
What tends to be the first thing you notice about a place?
I think after a while, and, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, 50 years, you start to see in the shape of the format of the camera that you're using.
Mm.
So a 4x5
is
4
inches. I hear in
sound
bites.
So you, you know, in fact, as I'm sitting here, sometimes I'll close one eye because then you see the way a camera does. You don't have depth perception. And then the alignment is so precise because now your head, curiously enough, is next to the photograph behind you of Doug Hamilton and you.
Right.
And if I was to make it even more sort of interesting photograph, I would just sort of move. There's a sweet spot in all this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can generally sort of zero in, but it's not till I'm on the ground that then I do the tweaking up, down, left, and right because there's just one place where it's the best.
Right, and that sweet spot. And,
yeah, so you're always hunting for that.
There is a moment in the book when you talk about visiting your grandparents in Mountain, and I think you're that androgynous 5 or 6 year old. And there are these moments where I believe it was your grandpa, you guys would go in the car, break off, clutch in, and just coast down these long rural North Dakota roads. How far do you think we can go? Is that a metaphor for how you live your life trying to find those sweet spots?
I don't know. I don't know. It is a great... It's a great image for me because it says so much about that place and the family rituals that we would do. Mm-hmm. I think I'm more kind of – I take away the fun rituals because he was a funster and he'd always say, come up with odd things like we might be sitting outside and he'd say, well – and he's talking to his grandkids now. How many pairs of socks do you think I have? And we go – come again, please. And they said, no, how many pairs?
Grandpas are weird sometimes.
We got a quarter on this. And so we'd all guess the number. And then we'd follow him into his bedroom, and he'd open up, and we'd count the socks, and someone would get a quarter or a candy bar. So, and coasting down was one of those rituals. And I took leave as an infant on her baptismal coast down the hill. Something. And a lot of families did it because it's on the west edge of the River Valley, the Pembina Escarpment.
Mm-hmm.
And that Schroeder's Hill is part of so many families' traditions, you know, coasting down and finding out and how far do you think we can go.
In the book, you There's an essay and a picture where you talk about including an overexposed image. And I'm thinking back to when you were my professor and how we were always aiming at getting that contrast perfect in that sweet spot. And someone who's published many books and has been in exhibits and museums the world over. And then you include an overexposed image. I just wonder, did it feel like a mistake? Was it something you had to sort of swallow and get over your pride? Or why include an image that I could not have handed in as a student to you?
Well, you could have. I wouldn't have.
I just would have gotten bad grades.
You just got a bad grade. I think it's sort of paying homage to the quality of light, because it's just so it's a rarefied light in Iceland. There's so little pollution. You've got the sun. You've got the water. You've got this amazing light that it took some time getting used to. So I think it was just sort of saying, this is an amazing place visually. So it won. I took second place on that one. So
the book is dedicated to your daughter, but there's also a mention in there of the lessons that you and your wife learned from a stillborn son. Putting together a book like this, decades after the kind of loss that will never leave you.
Well, that's one entry that I can't read out loud.
Yeah.
But I think in there, again, is this idea that fleeting moments can create place. And you know, when I use the word place, I'm talking about a sense of place, not just a legally recognized definition of a location. So that kind of had to be there. And this is four leaves, so it it was a painful thing, but it had to be in.
The book is called A Song for Leave. It is the latest book from photographer, writer, and professor emeritus Wayne Goodmanson. Wayne has a show opening at the Rourke in Moorhead, Minnesota on September 12th that include images from some photographs that he made on the White Earth Reservation. That one is called White Earth Window. And there's another sense of place exploration in an exhibit called What Place Is This? Wayne, thank you so much for your time and talent today.
Well, thanks. Good to be here. Good talking.
We'll have more Main Street after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The head of the state's Workforce Safety and Insurance Agency says North Dakota's benefits for injured workers compare favorably to other states. WSI is the state workers' compensation agency. Brian Klipfel told the legislature's Interim Workers' Compensation Review Committee WSI has low premiums plus a healthy surplus fund.
We always hear that, well, the reason your agency, your fund's doing so well, or why you have the surplus is because you don't pay benefits. But that's not true. We have a very good benefit structure. And when you compare it to other states, we're in the top quarter.
Klipfel says the rates employers pay for that insurance is lowest in the nation. And he told the committee the rates of on-the-job injuries have dropped.
It's attributed a lot to the type of industry we have in the state. You know, remember we had the boom with a lot more hazardous type of work in there. Anyway, the numbers are coming down and we hopefully we attribute that to our safety programs.
And a recent national report showed 49 of the 50 states are reporting teacher shortages. North Dakota is no exception to that.
North Dakota has been experiencing teacher shortages for a number of years.
State School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says the shortages are reported in virtually every area of teaching.
It used to be that elementary teachers, there were a lot of teachers to fill those jobs. Even elementary teachers are in a shortage area right now. Critical shortage areas are our special education teachers, our math teachers, our science teachers, our family and consumer science, and even our agriculture teachers.
Basler says there has been concern that some teachers would leave the profession after the challenges of the last school year brought on by COVID-19.
We actually have found on a national level that there wasn't a significant increase in retirements or teachers leaving the profession at the end of this school year. So I think that speaks a lot to the dedication that our educators have to their profession, their vocation of teaching young people.
Basler says there's no silver bullet to address the teacher shortage. She says one component is to elevate the image and prestige of teaching.
I think that is critically important, that we support our teachers in our communities, that our communities show them that they are valued and that they are honored and that they are held in high regard because of the wonderful hard work that they do.
And Basler says while pay isn't everything, pay does matter. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation. Now accepting applications for the Bush Fellowship through September 9th. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Joining me now is Scott Davis. He is the former Indian Affairs Commissioner, and he is here to talk about this year's inductees to the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashley.
So there is an event coming up tomorrow in Bismarck for the 2021 honorees. I want to start, before we even say who those members are, the significance of the name Hall of Honor when it's so often you hear something like Hall of Fame. So the significance of the word honor in this context.
Sure. Yeah, great question, Ashley. You know, as the founder and curator of the Hall of Honor here, you know, when I started this thing years ago, it was, you know, the first question was, what are we going to call it? You know, because I was approached by a number of folks back then saying, hey, we really need a Hall of Fame. I said, yeah, I totally agree. But looking more in depth about, you know, a cultural word, if you will, of what fame versus something else would mean that would honor our relatives, our committee just came up with the word honor. So I think that was appropriate. So here we have it, you know, and we're, you know, started back in 2016, 15. I would say for me, it probably started around 2012. And here we are today with a number of inductees, including tomorrow night, three more being inducted tomorrow night in the Native American Hall of Honor. So we're pretty excited and really have seen this thing grow, and that's it's a really great opportunity for a lot of people to come out and share and look at what the significant impacts Native Americans have had to our tribes, our state, and our country.
Well, let's talk about the significant impacts of this year's honorees. Let's start with Lydia Sage Chase. She is of the Mandan Hidatsa Arikara Nation, and I should say the late Lydia Sage Chase.
Yes, you're correct. Yeah, Lydia was quite the leader. I don't want to let anything out of the bag yet here, but quite the story about her. Her life's journey, from community-wise, statewide, national-wise. You've had some. You'll probably see and hear about some local folks really giving her well-due accolades, but also from a national level as well. So, really excited that she was inducted this year, and look forward to seeing her story tomorrow night.
Well, people will be able to see that story tomorrow in Bismarck, and also coming up in the few weeks in the near future, or maybe in a couple of months, we'll be able to air the audio version of the videos that are made for these people. But can you give us a little bit more there of a teaser on what she really meant to her people? Because this is an obituary that reads almost like a love letter to a great source of power.
Right, right. Well, definitely an inspiration to a lot of, you know, young ladies, that's for sure, from what I have read and known about her. I met her once many, many years ago in passing, but, you know, when I think about her and her her background, especially with education, you know, and how the impact she's made with students in particular, I think that's a story you're probably going to hear and read and see from her. So her her legacy certainly is going to live on much stronger, and I'm sure there's going to be more younger Lydia Sage Chases here to come.
Hmm. When we talk about nominating a person who is now deceased, how does that process work?
Yeah, so we have an open application every year around, I would say, around February. You know, we open the nomination process open to anybody. So again, if you're in the areas of military, veterans, leadership, and also with sports, athletics, and so forth, you know,
and there's also an arts and culture.
Arts and culture, yes, missed that one. But you really have a pretty good chance of getting in. So I think within those four categories, you know, whomever and however you lived your life, whether it was on tribal council, leadership, you know, a veteran, a good athlete, part of a team, or you serve this country, or in the case of, you know, some of the folks that have been inducted with culture and arts, you know, with, you know, the storytelling, the arts and crafts we've done, you know, and so forth, you really have a really good chance to get in. Then we also, 3 years ago, we crafted a legendary category because there was a number of people, well, how come Chief Four Bears isn't inducted? How come Chief Sitting Bull isn't inducted? How come, you know, all these great chiefs that we've had in the past, how come they've never been inducted? So, and we kept saying to the folks, I said, well, nobody's nominated them.
Mm.
So instead of kind of waiting for people to do that, our committee just took it upon ourselves to kind of go around tribe by tribe and induct into the legendary category a prominent chief leader of the past, like Chief Little Shell 2 years ago, and then this year Chief Sitting Bull, Sitting Bull. So either MHA will be up next, or Spirit Lake Nation, or Sister Dakota Oyate will be up next for their legendary award regarding their prominent chiefs.
Yeah, you think of somebody like Chief Sitting Bull, played such an immense role in leading his people, among them, of course, the Battle of Greasy Grass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, when it comes to inducting somebody, I mean, it's almost, when I first saw his name listed, I thought, oh, why is it just now, you know, that this hasn't...
Right.
Come up. It was sort of like a almost too obvious. You don't see it sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the reason why a committee decided, hey, let's just create a legendary category. And, you know, and with any prominent chief from our past, it's really hard to really nail down the story because there's been so much books and history written about them. And of course, you have family stories as well. So in this case, I think, you know, Mokoche Studios, who does a great job of articulating the storyline for these inductees, they do a great job of really getting a historical and contemporary view of who Sitting Bull was. So it's going to be an exciting moment, personally for my tribe as well. I mean, I'm from Standing Rock, and I'm really excited to.
He was a Hunkthapa Lakota warrior. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So.
How is his legacy told among your people?
Oh, just with reverence, you know, huge honor. I mean, he's the, you know, the hierarchy of our people, that's for sure. you know, it's just really, really, I think it's really personal because everybody refers to him as a Lala, as a grandfather, you know, to our people, you know, one who really paved the way for us in a lot of ways, not just with greasy grass, but other ways, the way he lived his life, conducted his life, and ultimately how he cared for our people.
Right. He set himself out as somebody who, am I correct in thinking that he got the name Sitting Bull after going out on, was it a warring ride where eventually he proved such bravery that the name more accurately translates to the buffalo who takes watch over all the other buffalo? Is it like that?
Yeah, pretty much, you know. Okay. And like I said, there's so much, you know, legendary stories like that of how he came to be as a young man into a warrior, into a prominent leader for people. So, you know, that's an exciting part of these stories, you know, and it's really given our people across not just North Dakota, but in the country, the true story of who we are. You know, as we know, a lot of these books have been written about us. It's been a big, big push here, even during my time at the state, is to change, you know, the history, the curriculum. And now we've passed some laws, you know, some good legislation to really make sure that, you know, the correct history has been implemented in our school system. So, and this is part of it, you know, he's a part of it. So, so when you have, you know, the correct stories of it, the truth, it really helps educate, you know, the young minds into who we are and who we are not.
Yeah. You know? Are you seeing a significant increase in the understanding of the way that the story of how the United States came to be has been just horrendously skewed?
Yeah. You know, it's always, I guess, from the time in history to even till now, you know, it's the kind of the you know, who written it, who wrote it, who researched it, who did they talk to, who do they, you know, on, and is it factual? And so, and that's all we've always said from the time I was being taught by my dad and, you know, him as an educator, teacher, educator, you know, administrator, college president, you know, he really fought hard to correct the history books. And here we are. And it takes time, you know, but it takes efforts like this. Partnerships, you know, with the Historical Society, the Heritage Foundation, to really make these things work. So we're excited, you know, we're excited. We're on the right path. We've been on the right path, and we just keep plugging away and resetting that bar for the Hall of Honor, so that young ones, students, youth, can really look at these leaders and people of significance, and hey, you know what? You know, if I work hard and just you know, do the good things and live a good life. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll be in the Hall of Fame, Hall of Honor.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a big part of what we're trying to do here is do these things for the future of our young ones.
We're visiting with Scott Davis. He is the founder of the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. There is an induction ceremony tomorrow in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum for the 2021 honorees. And Scott, a few minutes ago, in specific to your answer about Sitting Bull, you said you wanted a historical and contemporary look at his legacy. But I'm thinking, too, just the story of the whole Native American Hall of Honor as it has progressed since you thought of the idea about 10 years ago, and then as it got started. The historical, someone like Sitting Bull, and then more contemporary people who are only recently passed or who are still involved in their communities today. If you were going to weave one golden thread through all of the inductees, what's a phrase that comes to mind?
Well, I think that word honor comes back to the forefront, you know, just the honor of honoring, you know, honoring these folks, teams, you know, people, the women, the men, the brave soldiers that really have ultimately through courage, strength, prayer, to really advance the Native American cause. You know, when I'm looking at this list here of, you know, Anthony McDonald, Dan Jerome, mm-hmm. Mary Louise Defender, you know, Patrick Gornall, Martin Cross, Charles Murphy, you know, Arnie Charging, Nathan Goodiron, you know, Richard Mercer, and you go on and on. Every one of those folks dedicated either their entire life or the majority of life into advancing our cause through education, through arts, through, you know, through sports, athletics, veterans, and so forth. And there's hundreds and hundreds out there that should be on this list. And I just always look to the community and people who know their community better than I do. Hey, you know, some of these folks are just average Joe citizens, and come to find out, I mean, you're going to hear one here with a veteran tomorrow with Mr. Dufany. What a story. A lot of people didn't know he was a decorated veteran because of the way he carried himself, you know, and that's how we're taught.
Yeah. Give us a little bit more of his story. He is of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa.
Yes. Yeah. Vietnam veteran. And as you know, veterans are held in high regard in the country.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to a powwow, and we're having one, a big one this weekend, and I hope people come out to the United Tribes powwow. What's the first thing you're going to see? You're going to see that flag. You're going to see the Eagle Staff. And what does that represent? Our country, our land, you know, protection. And so who's in the front? It's those veterans. And, you know, I've had family in my life. I've had uncles and grandpas. And every family, I would have to say, you know, safely, and I think I'm correct on this data point, is that everybody in North Dakota who is a tribal member, tribal family, has a veteran member in their family, every one of us, you know. So that's pretty significant. And we still serve at the highest rate of service per capita among any ethnic minority group. So what does that say? You know, so you have people like Mr. Dufany who stepped forward, and it's an interesting story. Again, I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag, but you're going to see a pretty significant story about him and his life.
Are there similar concepts across the nation? I mean, this would recognize and honor the five tribes represented within North Dakota, but there are nearly 600 across, you know, the landmass that is the U.S.
Right. Yeah, there are. There's one in Oklahoma. When I was working with Frank Bravendick, and this is kind of where it all started when I was working at United Tribes, this idea, and that was around 2008, in fact, when he and I talked and said, you know, really, you know, really be nice to have a Native American Hall of Fame. And so when I moved into the state office, he and I connected more frequently. And of course, he was a funder of many, many things in this area, and a good friend to us, and a good friend to Indian people. Mm. And so that's kind of where it kind of evolved and stuff. So, but he kept telling me, go down to Oklahoma. There's a Native American Hall of Fame down there. So I went and visited that. Kind of a small Hall of Fame area, but I got an idea of what it should look like, you know, as a curator. I mean, I didn't even know what the word meant, you know, 12 years ago, but when you're looking inside of a Hall of Honor, a museum, or a place of honor, you know, you have to make sure it's decorated and fitted with, you know, kiosks and glass cases and memorabilia, etc. So you've done a good job, you know, of making sure that things are appropriate when people come and visit the Hall of Honor. So, but yeah, there are a few of them out there.
Okay.
Some are, you know, it's like anything else. You got to raise money. You got to, you know, it's private dollars. This is not, and I'll say this strong, it's not a government entity. It's not controlled by the government. This is a private endeavor, kind of like the Cowboy Hall of Fame. So I'm always looking to raise money, private monies, and so forth. But that's always been the concept, and it's gonna remain that way as long as I'm still leading this effort.
And again, the induction ceremony for the 2021 honorees is tomorrow evening in Bismarck at the State Heritage Center and Museum. Now, Scott, you are the former Indian Affairs Commissioner. You are working now as head of Native American Community Outreach for Sanford Hospital. What a fun time to work in a hospital setting.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, well, you know, I've been here, you know, going on 3 months now. And
wow.
Even prior to that, as we know, COVID has been here for well over a year. And that entire time, my work with healthcare systems, tribal healthcare systems, you know, has been really, really in the forefront. So yeah. When I decided to move on and take this opportunity, because I'm adamant about healthcare with tribal members, including my own self, my own family, mm-hmm. You know, it was a great opportunity, and it's a big lift. It's, you know, make no doubt, it's a big lift. But Sanford, as you probably see and read about, have done some really significant things here on trying to, improve the healthcare systems mm-hmm. deliverable to all citizens, you know, across our region here, including Native Americans. So,
yeah.
So we have some things on the burner. You know, I'd be happy to share those at somewhere down the road, but. Exciting job, exciting opportunity, but again, another challenge that I'm up for. So pretty excited about this.
Things like pandemics have the tendency to disproportionately impact certain people groups that are already marginalized, and that's certainly been true on reservations across the country. How would you classify the state of access to vaccines or good health care or even just good information right now?
Well, fortunately, we've had good leadership in our tribes, you know, within our state. Like I said, you know, a year and a half ago, working directly with tribal leaders, clinical staff, you know, medical doctors, you know, knowing that, hey, you know, there might be some missed opportunity here or sometimes, as we know, tribes are left, you know, last in line for vaccines, for testing. Well, we made sure, you know, that through partnerships with the state that and with hospitals like Sanford that, hey, every citizen, no matter what, you know, Native American first, you're going to have access just like everybody else mm-hmm. to testing, to equipment, PPE, and vaccines. So kudos to the tribes. They've really worked very, very hard on a lot of those fronts, you know, making sure our people are safe and vaccinated. And the mandates, you know how political those things get, but mm-hmm. Fortunately, I haven't seen that, and I'm knocking on wood right now. I haven't seen the politicalness of vaccines and mandates and all those other things that America goes through. Tribal citizens, tribal leadership, tribal nations, you know, hey, you know, we know how critical healthcare is. We know it's very fragile, and anything that we can do to protect ourselves from things like COVID-19, we're doing it. And I see it's not perfect. You know, it's not perfect by no means. But and we recognize we're not out of the woods yet. You know, with the Delta variant and so forth surging, it's time to get back and bear down again and get back to the basics of where we're at here months ago and doing our best, doing our part to control the spread. So I see a heavy lift here, a lot of concern with tribal leaders going through the same thing we did here months ago.
Scott Davis, head of the Native American Community Outreach for Sanford Hospital and also founder of the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. The induction ceremony for this year's honorees is tomorrow in Bismarck. Scott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. Thanks for helping us out here.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's lifelong learning community. Information about classes and events at humanitiesnd.org.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
is your job truly future-proof? The deal has changed. There's no certainty.
It's really scary. It's crushing.
You need to continually learn throughout your whole lifetime.
Everyone does everything.
We burn the boats. We're not going back.
Future of Work.
Watch Future of Work, Future Proof tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 8th. Too much or too little water are extremes North Dakota knows all too well.
terrible droughts, and destructive floods dot the state's history. On the wet side, there was the historic 1897 Red River flood and the mammoth rains of the 1990s that swelled Devil's Lake. On the dry side, nothing tops the Dust Bowl when temperatures soared into the triple digits, wind blasted away soil, and farmers and ranchers were left in ruins. The drought of 1988 also brought North Dakota to its knees. Farmers lost more than $1 billion. Federal aid reduced those losses to about $700 million. Crop insurance helped, too. Three-quarters of the state's wheat, barley, and oats were lost in the drought. The U.S. Agriculture Secretary declared a disaster that year, which opened the door for some federal aid. Governor George Sinner asked President Reagan twice for a presidential disaster declaration, calling the drought the worst natural disaster in our state's history. Sinner postponed and restricted hunting seasons, banned woodcutting with certain tools, and restricted vehicle traffic to certain roads. An agricultural meteorologist described the situation as an utter and complete disaster. By mid-June, wind had blasted away more than 450,000 acres of topsoil. Bismarck, in 1988, logged 12 days at or above 100 degrees, the most since the record 14 days set in 1936. Cities and counties across the state banned the sale and use of fireworks due to the fire danger. On this date, in 1988, the Bismarck Tribune reported on wide-ranging effects. 11 Kidder County farmers cut 18,000 square bales of hay in Idaho to ship back to Steele, North Dakota by train. Wildlife also suffered due to the heat and lack of rainfall. Hungarian partridge broods declined. Sharp-tailed grouse reproduction dropped. The Game and Fish Department reduced the daily limit for sharptails from 3 birds to 2. 1988 went down as one of the driest and warmest years for Bismarck, Dickinson, and Jamestown. News editors and broadcasters ranked the terrible drought as the top North Dakota story of 1988. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You don't have to get off the beaten path to notice that things are a bit different in the American Southwest.
In the Southwest, the sky is your ocean.
See what a national park like Utah's Canyonlands can show you.
It is an erosional landscape that reminds us how young we really are.
Or cross the desert with a rugged mountain bike tour.
The colors are always a little brighter if you had to bleed for them.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the inaugural Williston Basin International Airport Air Show is coming up this weekend. And we get a preview of the event along with some changes to the airport and airlines servicing the Williston area. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.